Today on the 22nd of March, this is a continuation of the meeting we had yesterday with Chevron, and they're joining us today online. We have with us Senator Green, Senator McGuire, Huggins, Stedman, and Wilikowski, and expect Senator Wagner to join up with us shortly. We're continuing testimony-wise today on Senate Bill 104. In the sense we had Chevron here yesterday, we got caught short on time. They flew back to Houston. They're online, and we will just continue our line of questioning. And just for an announcement for tomorrow, that we will be meeting at 1:30 tomorrow. We'll be hearing from Anadarko, BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon. And a reminder, that's the meeting will start at 1:30 and will go to 5:30. So with that. Vince and Tim, we say thank you again for making your flight back and rejoining us today. And we have some questions from the committee members, so if you will stand by, questions to follow.
Very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, if I might, the first question, one of the terms you used yesterday in speaking on Chevron's position had to do with risk mitigation. And would you just revisit that issue and broaden our perspective maybe on it and your concerns?
I'm trying to recall the context for the comment on risk mitigation.
Well, part of it was during the discussion of the open season and the risk. Then we talked about other things. I can't remember how many other times we talked about it, though. You want to just talk about it generally?
Yes, and as you see in the context of the project as it is framed in AGEA, concerns you might have in mitigation of the risk.
So from the Chevron perspective as a customer, the big risk comes down to, in an open season, signing up for something where you don't exactly know what you're going to get and what it's going to cost, but you're making these large financial commitments a whole lot earlier than you otherwise would on a normal development timeline when you're going through your phase gate. And so the types of things that can happen where what you wind up getting is different than what you expected, there's all sorts of things related to the what it actually winds up costing, when it actually winds up being in service, if it ever does actually make it into service or not. There is completion risk as well as the cost overrun risk. And then the terms and conditions regarding how you compute the rate and what the other parameters of service are, those can wind up being different than what you expected, and you wind up either paying more or not getting what you expected for your money as far as the flexibility on the services, and your economic returns suffer. So is there a particular part in there you like expounded on in a little more detail?
No. I just wanted to get us kicked off here, and that was one of the things that I had noted.
Vince? I was going to add just one comment to that. So Tim just, I guess, elucidated on a few of the risks that are faced, and I guess when you come back to, I think what your question was, which was risk mitigation, the mitigation would be steps you could take with regard to each one of those that would bring more certainty to, or there would be a shared ownership of an impact of a negative, or in some cases, I guess, a positive outcome. So the mitigation would be around how you would share those risks, or you would equally, the impact would be equally felt by the various parties involved. And that's where the context of, or the concept of alignment becomes important.
Yeah, thank you. And a follow-up on a different subject has to do with the cost of the project.
Mr. Chairman, same subject?
Yep. Go ahead. Yeah. Senator Wagner.
I got a question. How is the risk on this project any different than any other pipeline project that a company becomes involved in?
My impression is that the risks aren't aren't different, but the scope and the scale of the impact of those risks is substantially different because of the scale or the nature of the project. When you have a project that is unique, when you have a project that depends on specific technologies to be successful, I think the risks are similar, but perhaps the range of outcome is or the uncertainties are such that it takes on new meaning.
To add on a bit to that, the risks are, as Vince laid out, the same. This would be a basin opening pipeline, similar to, say, the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, which is currently in its approvals in Canada, or the Maritimes and Northeast pipeline was from Nova Scotia down to Boston. And so there are some additional risks for the first pipeline in an area regarding what is everyone else supposed to do when you're not sure if that pipeline is actually going to move forward or what its timeline will be. If there's already a gas network and a natural gas business in the area, that risk is a little bit smaller in that there is something going on. But for a basin open pipeline, it's by definition the first.
And I guess one other dimension that makes this a little bit different is that it actually is a multinational pipeline, and that's not necessarily a typical thing, although I guess over some of the pipelines in Europe, that certainly isn't unique.
Yeah, and if I could, both Vince and Tim, this is Charlie Huggins here. When you speak, say your first name so that for the record we understand who we're hearing from.
Very good.
And I just got a note that says that Kevin Tabler of Chevron is online just to listen, just so that if you're aware, if you weren't aware of that.
They always know that I'm always listening.
Oh, very good.
We can now direct some questions.
Yeah, Kevin, where are you located?
I'm located in Anchorage right at the moment.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, since you're in Anchorage, let me transition quickly to a question on the cost of the project. This morning I was reading the Anchorage newspaper, and Chevron was in the newspaper, and there was a comment that was made, and it goes about like this. The article stated that Chevron has said that the cost of the pipeline would be between $20 and $30 billion. My memory is not as good as it was once upon a time. I do not remember you talking about a cost, but would you refresh my memory?
Yes, and in fact that's a good pickup. We did not make that statement. That statement was not made. I'm not sure how the Anchorage Daily News picked that up or where they cited that information from. I believe what was said was, and Vince, you can, I'll let you speak to it. It was your comment, but that there was a wide range of thoughts out there as to what the total cost would be. But that was as specific as we got.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, and looking at this, and it certainly is one of the issues that we really struggle with. But I think looking at the work that was done by Bechtel for the LNG project, looking at the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, there are bases with which to make estimates. But we certainly would view it as, you know, 30 would be at the very, very low end, and probably, you know, it's certainly north of 40.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Wagner?
We heard a lot about risk for the last 2 years, but, you know, you guys are in a real risky business. So I'd like to get an answer to this question. As far as you're committing your gas that you control on the North Slope, would there be any difference between committing it to a gas line built by a independent company or a gas line built by the producers or one of the producers?
Well, this is Vince. There are differences within that, and they take a couple different perspectives. One is how we run economics internally depend on in some depth on that position in terms of ownership, and really don't want to go too much more into that because I'm really not prepared, or perhaps not the right person to talk about that. But on the other hand, the risks that are undertaken by those that have to make the firm transportation commitment, so they're signing up to pay the price of the pipeline, it is very important in terms of who is making the open season and how confident the companies that participate in that open season are in the company that's going to deliver the project. It's a very important factor, and the perspective of a company's ability, one company's perspective on another company's ability to deliver on that type of commitment is going to vary. Tim, perhaps you could expand on that a little bit.
I think you pretty much laid it out there. This is Tim. I'm at the same concern you are, Vince. I'm not really prepared to go into the nuances of the valuation. It would make a difference, particularly when it comes to managing your risk and making decisions in a coordinated fashion with timeline that the pipeline is on, whether you're a part of the pipeline and knowing what's going on, or whether you're an outsider just getting whatever information trickles out. It's a lot easier to manage your spend and control your economic results when you've got the maximum amount of information and participation in all the decisions.
Senator Wagner?
I guess an analogy would be if you were going to build a house and you had built houses in the past and you were familiar with the house building process, but somebody came to you and said, well, what we need you to do is commit to purchase a house, and but by the way, we're going to bring somebody else in to build that house for you.
Yeah, Senator Wagner.
It would be very dependent on your comfort with the builder that was chosen for the house and how familiar you are with their abilities and their performance in the past.
This is Tim, to follow up on that analogy, and the house that you're actually going to be delivered at closing is not necessarily the pictures you saw in the brochure, and the price isn't necessarily the price that was printed in the brochure.
Well,
so it's all risk.
Yeah, I realize the differences, but so you're saying you would prefer to have a producer-owned pipeline and producer-built pipeline than you would a private pipeline company-built product. Is that what I hear you say?
Well, when we do our economic evaluation, it's easier to have more control and make better decisions, the ones that we have to make to be a customer of the pipeline, and to help the pipeline make decisions that are aligned with our needs if we're at that table with a vote. So it can improve the result for all the participants having the most informed people at the table.
Okay, one last question. How many privately owned and privately operated pipelines do you ship gas on, and how many producer-owned gas lines do you ship gas on?
Our North American gas marketing organization probably moves gas on every regulated pipeline in the U.S. and probably Canada. So we do business on a lot of pipelines owned by pipelines. We also own some pipelines ourselves as Chevron, and so we do business on those, and I don't know about pipelines owned by other people that are private that we do business on. Does that give you a sense of an answer, or do you need something more specific?
No, that's fine.
Yep. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to go ahead and follow up on Senator Wagner's question. What's the largest pipeline Chevron has built, gas line, you know, in dollars? And then that's one part of the question. The other part of the question is it common or uncommon within the industry for the major producers to build a pipeline, in particular gas pipelines, and then divest themselves of it after sometime after construction to free up the capital onto higher returning assets?
This is Vince. On the pipeline, I'm certain that we're not necessarily the right people to ask that question of, and we can go find the right answer. I know that there are a couple of pipelines that we have involvement in and partial ownership in over in Azerbaijan from a Unocal legacy standpoint, and I suspect over in Kazakhstan, there are some very large pipelines that were laid to connect that resource to market as well. But we're going to have to follow up with information on that. I'm not sure we're necessarily the qualified people to answer that. And I apologize for not really having that at our fingertips.
Well, on the this is Tim, and through the chair, on the second part of the question, yes, there have been pipelines that were conceived and driven by producers through the open season process, through the regulatory approvals and the construction contracting, and that once they'd reached the point where they had applied the maximum amount of cost control they could in order to help deliver the best project, some of the producers have decided to sell off pieces of their interests. And so the ownership of the pipeline, once it starts up, can wind up being different than the ownership of the pipeline at the time of the open season. But that's just a method of helping the best people be at the table to make decisions that are the ones that hit their bottom line the hardest. So the situation you alluded to has occurred in cases, and it's hard to predict because those decisions get made at the time based on the circumstances at the time.
This is Stedman again. Should we consider in AGEA putting in a clause that would require divestiture of the line after a particular amount of years after first gas, regardless of who constructs it?
This is Tim. I'm not sure what that would do for you if, say, Pipeline A wins the license. That number of years after startup, they have to sell to Pipeline B. I'm not sure that would get you a better project compared to having the one person continue to own it or selling it or selling interest in it as it makes sense as they see fit.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
I want to follow up.
We have a follow-up on that from Senator Wagner.
Did you say a producer-built line? Or
I didn't specify.
Yeah, because I don't think there'd be any reason for a private pipeline company to have to divest themselves of the ownership. I just want to point that out.
Yeah, would you address that if it was, as Senator Stedman's question was rephrased to whether it was a producer built pipeline and then there was a divestiture requirement? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are quite a few pipelines that have marketing affiliates, that is, companies that actively buy and sell gas and ship gas on their affiliated pipelines. And so I'm not quite sure if you're talking about just saying that it would be producers that would have to sell or if it would be any affiliated entity of that company that winds up being a customer. And when I start looking at it a little more broadly, it gets a little complex. If it's a regulated pipeline, if the decisions that are being made by that pipeline are consistent with the public interest, I don't see the benefit of a forced sale.
Okay, thank you.
It all comes down to, are the parties aligned? are the decisions being made that move things down the path that all parties collectively agree is the right path? And if that's the direction things are moving, then that's the way you want them to go.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, I'll withdraw my question. Thank you.
Yep. Vince and Tim, question for you. If this is on page 11 of the bill, starting with line 14, and it has to do with a scenario of what the pipeline builder's capability is. And I'll read you the first part. It said, if the licensee has credit support sufficient to finance construction of the project through ownership of rights to produce and market gas resources, firm transportation commitments, or government financing, the licensee shall sanction the project within 1 year after the effective date of Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity issued by the FERC. Okay, so if you have the financial wherewithal, the commitments, you got 1 year. If you don't, the same scenario, you have 5 years. Would you give me your thoughts on those two provisions? I'm sorry, go ahead.
So my an observation or maybe a perception, and I feel like I'm walking a little bit on thin ice, but I'll kind of go out there, is that the financial strength of a company is only one of the measures of the time frame that should be required. The capability of the company and the availability of the right resources and or their ability to bring the right resources to bear should, you know, it seems to me would be an equally or even more important element of that time sensitivity of decision making.
Yeah, how I read the paragraph is essentially one had a successful open season, the other didn't.
Well, this is Tim. The idea of a successful open season, though, you've got a few other risks that get touched on by that paragraph but aren't explicitly stated. If, in order to project finance the pipeline, if you're presuming that the pipeline will go out and borrow the money, it's possible that they could have a successful open season as far as getting sufficiently credit-worthy customers expressing interest for service on the pipeline, but that it's hard to find someone that has $35 billion to lend or that can syndicate a loan that big for a project-financed multinational pipeline. So the open season can still be successful, but you don't necessarily have things that will actually let you get to financial close on the project to enable you to move to the next steps. This, as Vince was saying yesterday, this project will make its own weather. It will define and change the world just by it moving forward. And some of these things are just very large compared to all the other projects that have gone before them. It will have a much bigger impact.
Questions? Okay. Yes, Senator Stedman?
I'd like to talk a little bit about the linkage of PPT, which was set up under another scenario, under another administration, with the gas, and what your thoughts are on that, and if you feel that we should review that, or if you think that's should be best left alone and you're comfortable with it.
This is Vince. I think we'd have to really sit down and consider that more and think that through a little bit more. I think the tax rate on gas, you know, depending on the economics and how you view the economics, the tax rate is going to be a hugely sensitive issue. And so I think we, Chevron or myself, we need to actually really take that and think about it more. I'm not sure we're prepared to really make a comment on it.
This is Tim. To follow up, an example of one of the parts that's confusing or uncertain is, in addition to the tax rate, there's the progressivity based on oil price, and trying to understand what the oil price scenario is regarding what the tax rate would be on the gas you produce when the gas and the oil prices aren't necessarily related adds multiple layers of complexity to the evaluation. It makes it a lot harder, once you've even computed a number, to feel confident that it's that it has any validity. So there's a lot of uncertainty around how that structure would apply to a gas line and what assumptions we should make as we do those evaluations.
So do you feel that should be reviewed and possibly modified before or after open season?
This is Ben. I think it's, taxation is always such a touchy subject. I think I would recommend really leaving PPP in place as it is, you know, for at least a period of time before it's changed, just so that we get a better sense of how it works and the implication of it is as we start to look at and think about this project. It's hard to understand all of the implications of it at this point in time.
Let me clarify my question, because I'm not referring to the gas or the oil portion of PPT. I'm referring specifically to the progressivity linkage in gas. And how would your company deal with such linkage if it's left in there when you walk into an open season with that type of a gas structure tax?
Yeah, this is Vince. I think we're going to have to plead that we're really going to have to work that problem more to provide a more suitable answer, or an answer that we feel confident in.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Vince, yesterday one of you made the statement, "Bill can't change fundamental economics of project." I wrote that down in large letters. And then somebody later on took a red pen and circled that, like they thought it was very important what you said. It's one of those capstone comments. Would you refresh our memory about what you really meant in that comment?
This is Ben. From my perspective, the value of a project is based on some very basic things. It's based on the investment, the time of the investment, the product, the market available for, and the price of the product on that market. And those create value. Being able to take gas from one area and sell it to somebody else in another area, there's a basic economic engine there. And so from my perspective, that's the base economic case, is before you start trying to divide up the value of that project, the value of that economic engine, it is what it is. Now, the bill, or how risk is shared, or how investment is made, will start to divide up the value of that project. And so my comment was, or the context of the comment was, that the bill in and of itself doesn't necessarily change that, the economic. It will start to work on how that value is shared, how the risk is managed, or how alignment is created, but it doesn't really change the underlying economics.
Other questions? Okay, let the record show that Senator Stevens and Senator Wagner has joined us, and Senator McGuire has rejoined us.
Sure.
Yep. And Senator Stedman has a question.
So I'd like to ask Chevron what their thoughts are on the 2-year requirement for open season, and if they think that should be lengthened or shortened. and the pros and cons of that.
Perhaps you could answer.
I guess you're pointing to me. This is Tim. Through the chair, the amount of time you need to do an open season and the amount of time you get are very important in running a good open season. So if you want the customers to be convinced that this is a realistic schedule being proposed, a realistic cost being proposed, and the project has been scoped, they've selected a good platform for it so that there's the right amount of expandability there to meet future and growing needs, then you would potentially need more time. Whether 2 years is enough, it sounds like it should be, but do you want to write a hard restriction in that would potentially limit you if 2.5 years winds up being what is actually needed? So if you make the commitment potentially a little too tight, then you run the risk of having an open season being run under less than ideal conditions with less than ideal information being shared, and then not getting the results that you desire. So I suggest the pipeline companies that you talk to would have a lot more experience on what level of information they'd feel would best meet everyone's needs. I'm more of a customer in those open seasons than actually the provider, so I can only really offer the customer perspective. But when I go into the open season, if you put a gun to my head and give me 90 days to decide, I'd like the best information reasonably possible in order to use in that decision.
I must have garbled up my question.
Please ask it again.
There's a requirement in the bill that every 2 years we have an open season, which...
Yes, I'm sorry. I was thinking of the requirement that you have to run the open season a set number of years after the license is given, but I thought that was 3. I apologize for answering the wrong question.
Well, that's okay.
The 2-year requirement looks like it's worded well in that the pipeline is free to do it as frequently as they feel the market needs, so long as they do it once every 2 years. And so if industry activity or other requirements mean they need to run them more frequently, they can respond to that need of the marketplace, and running one every 2 years shouldn't be an undue burden in order to just make sure that the pipeline is considering all the potential needs for capacity in its long-term planning. So if the within 2 years or at least every 2 years open season for expansion capacity makes sense, and it probably makes sense to even have those running before construction is completed.
Okay, thank you.
This is Charlie Huggins. When you look at what some have characterized as a perfect gas pipeline building storm, they have described it to me as this: multiple producers team with one or more pipeline companies, maybe other parties, and we get on with the project. Would you reflect on that concept?
I didn't quite make out the whole question, Vince. Did you want me to take that one? If so, I'd need it.
This is Vince. I was reflecting.
Okay.
So the perfect storm, meaning that there's a real opportunity, and this is how I interpreted your comment, there's a real opportunity to get the best producers and pipeline companies together to create the most efficient project possible. Is that what?
Correct. That is correct.
So, this is, again, I feel like I'm going out on a limb. I guess that is a possibility. It would be very, very important to think through, as I discussed yesterday, how this team would build alignment and share the risk between the various partners. If you know, as we talked before about our analogy, you've got one buyer of a house, and then you've got, you know, another who's the constructor of the house, and the degree to which they align their interests and share the risk is how you would have to manage that for maximum benefit. And do I know exactly how to do that? Unfortunately, I don't. But that's the key.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wagner?
Yeah, what kind of, when you start talking about risks, what kind of an effect will the federal loan guarantee on the $18 billion have on overall corporate risk for this project?
This is Tim. It depends on how the pipeline designs its rates and allocates them. If that $18 billion is cheaper than the rest of the money that they have to borrow, and if that flows through to the shippers, then there's a small benefit in a reduction in rates. But if there's still the same requirement on making payments and the same financial structure, as far as if the rate that we have to pay the pipeline is comparable to the value of the gas when it gets to the other end of the pipeline, and what do our cash flows look like, whether there's a loan guarantee on a piece of the money borrowed or not might not make a big difference to that underlying risk.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. Okay.
Yeah, other questions? Senator Stedman?
Could we address the five delivery points? In the bill, it calls for five delivery points, and under the previous administration, it was a less number, three of which can be identified. One of them couldn't be. And with your experience in Alaska, what would you recommend for takeoff delivery points that would be advantageous to the state over the next 50 years?
That's a great question. I think to me it seems like they've focusing on the major business centers of Alaska seem like the best, you know, the best answers there. I hesitate to say much more. Really, not necessarily qualified from that perspective or from a pipeline perspective and how that delivery would work. But you know, it seems like Fairbanks and certainly is one of them, but my apologies for a poor answer. I'm not sure that we could really say with any credibility.
Another question. Yeah. If we can go to the 70-30 equity debt split, and just looking at the McKinsey project and how challenged that's been dealing with the price of steel and the price of labor. Once we have a proposal, it'll be a few handful of years before construction, and clearly there's some risk there in costs. How would you recommend the state structure this bill to facilitate the developer not to be in a, or to not put the project in a disadvantage if we had a 30 to 40% cost overrun and a initial equity of 30% limit on it? In other words, how do we deal with substantial cost overruns and still keep the project from turning upside down any more than we have to, or any more it's forced to, I guess?
The developer will need to be able to have control of the project and be able to fund the equity requirement at whatever the cost wind up being. If you've got a applicant
who can fund the equity component of 30% at whatever the estimated costs are. And if you do get into those cost overruns, that's the wrong time for someone building a project of yours that's important to you to have them going out trying to borrow money when the story isn't all that good. So part of the selection has got to be that you want a proponent or group of proponents that have the balance sheet needed that they can fund their equity piece of the pipeline and there be no doubts about that. So if that's a concern you've got, it sounds like you might have picked the wrong applicant in that situation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for either Vince or Tim or Kevin? Well, once again, on behalf of Alaska Alaskans, but more specifically the legislature, we say thanks to Chevron and specifically to Vince, Tim, and Kevin for indulging us this afternoon. And again, thank you for yesterday and your answers and being candid with us. And I think we still have a marker to potentially visit with you on the 27th. Are you still up for that?
Let's see. Kevin is not. He will be on vacation. I'll be in California. But perhaps Mr. Zager and Mr. Houston could be, but we'll have to check and make sure.
Okay, we'll communicate with you offline on that. But again, thank you very much, and we appreciate it. And with that, we're adjourned.